Guys, welcome to the Breaking Down Current Affairs of the World podcast. This is your host Aryan Ghosh, and it has been quite some time since we did the last episode, and I really apologize for it. Lots of technical issues and etc. on the way, but we are back, and now we are back to covering all of those issues that have gone going on in the world. For the past 2 months, there have been significant developments taking place in different parts of the world, so we've got to break it down into different parts, and I'll start explaining them all and analyzing each and every one of them as I progress through the episode. So first of all, let's have a look at Asia. So let's have a look at first the military coup that had taken place in Myanmar back on the 1st of February, when the Myanmar military took over the democratically elected government of then State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi and detained her and a number of other senior figures from her ruling party, the National League for Democracy, the NLD. Now, let's remember one thing: the NLD had won in an election which took place the previous year, where there was no reports of voter fraud as such, although there were concerning reports that number of Rohingya Muslims not allowed to vote. Now, the military was in fact making these claims that without any proof that there was fraud, electoral fraud in the Myanmar elections. However, now they've taken the entire government by force, and there are a number of countries which have actually found themselves in hand with the military. As they're still now in power, the people have been trying to fight them off through different protests. Even missiles have been fired against them. However, the people of Myanmar have not stopped, and they've continued to fight for their democratic rights. However, different governments have been supporting the Myanmar military. For example, the Chinese and the Russian government have both been supporting that they haven't actually allowed the UNSC to release a statement condemning the entire military coup. They have simply shown a lot of concern regarding the amount of military action taking place, and that there should be a restraint in the type of action that the government takes against protesters. However, there has been no condemnation of the coup, and moreover, there is no way in which the UN Security Council is calling this a coup even in the first place. So there has been a lot of problems in the UN Security Council regarding this. No resolution condemning the coup can be passed even because of the Russian and Chinese governments keeping the military junta in power. Now, the most important point to consider is that in Asia, let's consider the entire world in perspective. As we see, there have been rising dictatorships in the world, and perhaps you will find Russia and China's play in almost each and every one of them. For example, if you take the Middle East, there is Syria and Iran, where the Syrian government is provided military support from the Russian government, and even when the Chinese government has some good relations with the Syrians. Then you have the Iranians, for example, who have just signed a big investment deal with the Chinese. Even they have had military support, military alliances or military relations with the Russians and the Chinese governments as well, which in fact shows that, you know, whenever there is a dictatorship formed, Russia and China find out a way to defend it. So especially the Syria is a very good example, because Syria back in 2011, when the Syrian civil war broke out, any kind of resolution which kind of condemned military action, or even which perhaps even held the Syrian government accountable for its military actions in the civil war, was completely vetoed by both the Russian and the Chinese governments. They both did a double veto in the UN Security Council, and the same fear lies in right now. Now, moreover, so this point to consider is primarily the India-China situation, because if you see Myanmar as a whole, India and China have a role to play. For example, even an Indian billionaire was accused of having funded the military junta, and even the Indian government has condemned the coup, but there seems to be quite some ambiguity evolving around how the Indian government is trying to hand off the military, because there have been, even along with Russia and China and the UN Security Council, India and Vietnam have also kind of prevented the Security Council, or actually shown negative reactions towards a condemnation statement. Now, if you want to analyze why this is actually happening, you have to go back to June 2020, where there was primarily a border standoff between India and China along the line of actual control, the LSE. Now, both these countries, ever since their border stand off, they have been trying to gain allies, not only in the world. This is primarily in Asia, because you need to ensure you have as many Asian countries helping you out, because you know, then you are surrounding the other countries, all of your allies. So, for example, India right now has been trying a lot for its vaccine diplomacy, has been trying to export vaccine in different parts of the world. Even Prime Minister Narendra Modi also visited Bangladesh when he went on to strengthen India-Bangladesh relations. Even there have been various attempts by the Chinese government also to try expanding its influence in Asia. It is, for example, if you take things like the ASEAN deal which took place, or even if you take, for example, the BRI or the Belt and Road Initiative, which is primarily what I believe the diplomatic and economic weapon which China actually possesses with itself. For example, you know, in Sri Lanka, the BRI was used for getting Sri Lanka into debt trap, which is pretty much, it shows that the Chinese government does not does diplomacy in bad faith, but still countries do in fact have a number of economic deals with China. Now the thing is that when that Myanmar itself was also a country which found itself between India and China, because the Myanmar government had earlier worked with the People's Republic of China to begin number of projects under the BRI, but then Aung San Suu Kyi went in and halted them, so a number of the Indian projects which were pending could be completed instead. Now, the military junta is primarily pro-China. If you see the number of visits the Chinese foreign minister has given to the military junta, etc., you will understand that the Chinese government clearly supports the military junta. Therefore, even if you know U.S. sanctions have been imposed, tough U.S. sanctions have been imposed, I believe that is, you know, in a way, I believe that right now the world has gotten so used to sanctions that U.S. sanctions are losing their effectiveness with time. And it is primarily a problem right now. So I'll talk about the sanctions later, but if you right now look at how China has been trying to draw this entire Myanmar issue out of the global, just trying to draw it out of the public sphere, if you look at how the ASEAN has been trying to address this issue, they have tried to address it. ASEAN has been able to, but if you look at ASEAN as a whole, it's very difficult to believe that ASEAN can actually do anything on Myanmar, because since ASEAN and China signed that deal in November 2020, it is a great ambiguity around it. Because you know, one important issue which ASEAN has actually not been able to take direct control on is primarily the South China Sea dispute. Because countries like Indonesia are members of the ASEAN, and Indonesia has a claim to a dispute, which is why ASEAN tends to either completely separate itself from the issue, or they try some other means to ensure a dispute does not break up the alliance. But then this clearly means that China can in fact not let the ASEAN take any progress in Myanmar. The UN Human Rights Office and a number of other different communities of the UN are condemning the amount of violence taking place against the people, and frankly there has also been talk of the R2P, the responsibility to protect. Now first of all, I'll make it a point to explain as to why are we looking at the R2P being brought here at this particular point. First off, before that, let's come to the point where I spoke about sanctions, right? So primarily US sanctions clearly do not work in effectiveness, because if you remember, before Aung San Suu Kyi came into power, before the NLD came into power, the military junta was under a great amount of sanctions from different countries around the world. Now newly the US, Canada and the UK have imposed sanctions in generals, and I tried to cut trade as well, but and even the EU has said it, the only way they're going to allow more investment and more trade is if democracy is back in Myanmar. However, actually I believe that these sanctions have actually never helped, because if you look at things, for example, like the sanction North Korea from the UNSC or and the US, they haven't worked. Because even, for example, a New York Times article just came out a couple of weeks ago, I believe, which quoted this report called Black Gold. I'll speak about it later, but this article clearly gave a lot of evidence which would prove that North Korea has been violating a great amount of oil sanctions. Then if you look at Iran, even Iran has actually, although Iran's economy has been pretty much strangled, the main motive of US sanctions on Iran were to curtail its nuclear weapon capabilities. Unfortunately for them, the Iranians have had a terrible economy during this COVID pandemic, and even the sanctions have added more pressure on them. But the nuclear weapons program continues to go on, and now they have now ever since a new attack on their Natanz facility, there's been more enrichment of uranium than ever before, which shows that sanctions have clearly failed in their objective. Therefore, now, if sanctions are to work effectively, the international community must target these sanctions as some of the most important sectors of Myanmar's economy. Since we've seen businesses close down in protest against the military coup, there is a possibility that, you know, with these businesses closing down, with people protesting against the military day in, day out, and then even with these sanctions targeting some of these important sectors in Myanmar's economy, that it choke the entire economy to this extent, where the military is forced to bow down and finally give in to a political transition process. But because right now strong army in the military isn't working, because even if people are protesting as a military, the military is hitting back with guns and weapons and missiles. So they clearly have no mercy against people, because even children have been killed and there are crimes against humanity being committed in Myanmar because of all of this. This could almost be a situation like, for example, like Syria, because we are seeing right now that in Myanmar, number of rebel groups have started plunging out. Even the UN is saying that this entire situation in Myanmar could become a conflict, a civil war, because now these ethnic tensions will be rising, and then these rebel groups will begin forming up again, and then they will rise against the military, they will get affiliated with terrorist groups, and again the entire cause of the protest will be lost, and then the Myanmar military will find straight justification for its actions. For example, if you see the Syrian government, when the civil war broke out, all those protests were peaceful, but then when they got violent, they got affiliated with these other groups, they got affiliated with the Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, and that's where the Syrian government got a very good way of justifying their actions by saying, we are killing terrorists, so we are using the harshest means of weapons. And frankly, it is pretty obvious any government would do that. So even in this case, if this goes into the civil war where people become rebel group, where people can group themselves as rebels and attack the government in violent manners through these rebel groups, they soon get affiliated with terrorist organizations. When they do, the government will have to take the harshest military steps, and then even then the international community cannot do anything about it. And for this very reason, the R2P doctrine has been brought into purview. Now let's understand the R2P first. So in 2005, there was a summit held, when it's a world summit, and there was a document which came into being, when it's a world summit outcome document, and this mentioned a responsibility to protect, wherein governments affirmed the responsibility to protect their own population, genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing and crime against humanity, and even accepted a collective responsibility to encourage and help each other uphold this commitment. Now in this very way, they also declared their preparedness to take timely and decisive action in accordance with UN Charter and other relevant regional organizations when national authorities manifestly failed to protect their populations. Now primarily, if you see the paragraph 138, it clearly states that each individual has this responsibility to protect its populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, crimes against humanity. Now if you look at paragraph 139, it actually does in fact give a detailed explanation as to how this entire R2B is functioning. That is, the international community through the UN also has responsibility to use appropriate diplomatic, humanitarian and other peaceful means in accordance with Chapter 6, Chapter 7 of the Charter to help protect populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, crimes against humanity. In this context, we are prepared to take collective action in a timely and decisive manner through the Security Council in accordance with the Charter, including Chapter 6, on a case-by-case basis and in cooperation with relevant regional organizations. As appropriate, should peaceful means be inadequate and national authorities manifestly fail to protect their populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing and crimes against humanity, and which has a need for the General Assembly to continue consideration for this responsibility to protect populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing and crimes against humanity. Now, you know, the very thing in this entire clause in that paragraph 139 clearly states the international community's objective to address any issues through diplomatic, humanitarian and other peaceful means, and they are even ready to take collective action in a timely and decisive manner through the Security Council. and you know, Security Council's mandate does consist of military action to be taken. So number one, if the R2P was once used earlier when it came to Libya, because in Libya Muammar Gaddafi, the dictator there, was committing crimes against humanity. And so the international UN Security Council, they passed a resolution to ensure that the military action to take place. NATO went in a counter-military operation, and the rebel groups, they ended up killing Gaddafi, and now Libya is stuck in a very bad civil war. Also, another reason why Russia and China have constantly vetoed resolutions quoting the R2P to invoke when it came to Syria. Now we'll talk about Myanmar. First of all, I believe it's very impractical, because if you tried invoking the R2P in a Security Council resolution, it will never be supported by India, by Vietnam, by China, by Russia. If these countries are not ready to go to the extent of allowing the Security Council to condemn the coup, forget about military action in Myanmar then. However, if you look at it in that perspective, it does in fact make a bit sense, because if military action is taken by the UN Security Council in Myanmar, you see that that diplomatic means haven't worked yet. Peaceful means of negotiation haven't worked with a military junta. And the military says that they will conduct elections as they feel so. Now, if the military conducts an election, it's pretty obvious that there will be certain amount of electoral fraud, because the military will try suppressing those voices which are anti-military of sorts. In that way, it would still result in a crushing of democracy in Myanmar, perhaps like a semi-democracy like Russia, wherein Russia, there's number of voter fraud allegations, as well as the fact that Russia itself, their president allows certain candidates to run, and they choose the candidates who will run, etc., etc. So the same thing is happening in the case of Myanmar. And therefore, trusting the military to carry out a comprehensive means of carrying out these elections, not really something I would entrust the military to. So the R2P here does in fact work, but again, a Security Council resolution highlighting that point will fail. It will never pass a Security Council, because China won't allow it, neither will the Russians. And even India and Vietnam will also express a great amount of concern regarding this, if not completely denying it altogether. So now, since we come to conclusion, it is important that the international community becomes much more active in engaging with the Myanmar military in this manner, because if the Myanmar military continues to engage in violence, this will be an outright civil war. And I do agree with the UN when I say this, that there will be an outright civil war if international actions are taken and Myanmar will just become a lost battlefield. So it is important right now that the international community steps up and engages in immense amount of negotiation with the Myanmar military to ensure that there is a great amount of peace in the region. And also, there should be negotiations for a transitional process by which there can be democracy restored, because the military needs to understand, if the military cannot hold Myanmar hostage for long, because there will be time when the people can in fact choke the economy, when sanctions will choke the economy and the military will not be able to take it. Although it is known that the military had sanctions imposed them earlier, if the international community takes it in a coordinated way, in a way which targets some of the middle sectors and significantly damages the economy, it would do a great deal of damage to Myanmar military's power in Myanmar as a whole. And therefore the military needs to sit down immediately and understand the need to step up to negotiate with the international community and to ensure transition process which would allow peace to prevail and allow democracy to return. So now that we've completed our entire discussion on Myanmar, now it's important to consider another important country in Asia which clearly has been getting the news, that is North Korea. Now North Korea in itself, if you look at it, it's got sanctions imposed on it because of its nuclear weapons program, and frankly, these sanctions, they have gotten oil sanctions and other kinds of sanctions imposed on North Korea, and it has made it one of the least open economies in the world. But one thing has obviously been an important part of discussion, that is North Korea violating certain sanctions imposed on it? Because already we have seen North Korea has conducted nuclear tests in violation of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. And the most important part right now is the Biden administration is trying to approach the North Korean government with certain negotiation ideas. However, the North Korean government has been rejecting them. These are the news coming in that Kim Jong-un has actually been warning Biden to not like prevent this situation getting worse in North Korea. And you know, just a couple, I think about a month ago, a report known as Black Gold was published by the non-profit think tank known as C4ADS and the Royal United Service Institute, which actually gives a lot of detail regarding how North Korea has been in fact violating its oil sanctions. And even the New York Times also quoted this article while they were also publishing an article exposing the way in which North Korea was violating its oil sanctions, or has been, frankly. So I'll just give you a bit of a detail, a little bit of an insight into the report. So primarily, if you, first of all, to get some background in it, North Korea primarily relies on the outside world to import fuel. So, you know, reserves are like primarily limited, so reserves and limited domestic refinery capacity, imports of refined petroleum products are vital to the government, because it ensures the stability and survival of North Korea. And you know, although in all modern economies, energy predicated on a constant flow of fluid into country, it underpins North Korea's domestic and export economy, and as well as Pyongyang's capacity to train and field armed forces and for develop weapons of mass destruction, WMDs. Now, the very thing is that the international community's efforts to cap North Korea's oil and petroleum products imports in 2017 forced Pyongyang to adapt its fuel procurement strategy. And this report, actually, which is titled Black Gold, actually shows North Korea has been engaging with organized crime networks and participating in a regional fuel smuggling market in violation of international sanctions. And it is demonstrating increasingly sophisticated and previously unseen tactics to evade detection. Now, the important thing to consider here is that these report's findings are extremely crucial for the international community to understand, because if the 1780 committee, or the committee which is formed to impose sanctions and review the sanctions on North Korea, it is important for them to consider this entire situation as a whole and to understand as to how to approach North Korea. Because as I said in the previous time when I spoke about Myanmar, sanctions aren't going to work, because they haven't worked in a case of Iran, haven't worked in a case of North Korea. And here we are seeing North Korea, literally, they're avoiding UNSC sanctions. They're being able to easily violate them and still get away with it. So I'll just point out, like, there has been executive summary of the report which has been presented, and I like to, like, point out the important points to be considered here. That is, first, being North Korea being tapping into an existing fuel smuggling economy in East Asia to procure fuel at volume. And it would show that smugglers divert fuel from the illicit market to sell to various customers, one of which is North Korea. So it also shows that the black market or illicit market is being tapped by the North Koreans to gain a lot of that oil. Second is that Taiwan appears to be a key focus in the regional black market for fuel. So Taiwan has certain fuel policies which price retail refined petroleum products lower than those of its neighbors, and therefore it helps in providing those conditions that allow arbitrage and a cheap and readily source of fuel for even smugglers. And therefore it has been shown in the report that several of networks and entities engaged in North Korea's fuel smuggling, they all operate from addresses of ports in Taiwan. And so the country's waters are being exploited by these illicit actors, and they are ensuring ship-to-ship transfers of fuel in a multi-layered shuttle system, and it bisects both dirty vessels traveling directly to North Korea and clean vessels discreetly supplying those dead delivery tankers with fuel in the high seas. Now, third is, which is one of the most key findings, that is, North Korea's illicit fuel supply chain has links to organized crime. And several of these key actors come from or maintain direct connections to the Fujian province in China, and in particular the city of Shishi, because these provinces and the coastal cities have been a regional smuggling hub for illicit goods, cigarettes, wildlife products, drugs and fuel. And these actors, they consider a loose criminal federation whose interests and activities intersect to smuggle fuel to North Korea. And the fourth, which is also another important point to consider, is the key node in a DPRK or the North Korean fuel procurement network, which is the Vinson Group, or which is a major regional oil trader. So Vinson Group is regarded as one of Asia's major international energy trading companies, and you know, it's very well known for its oil trading and bunkering business in Asia, and it's got offices in Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, mainland China. and it provides its customers a full range of services. Now it now North Korea, now the Winston Group, which is headquartered in Singapore, it has links to several shipping and trading companies in the region, as well as businesses registered in secrecy jurisdictions, through which it has connections to possible ship-to-ship transfers of fuel and ultimately end up in North Korea. So it seems, and also the report finds that the founder of the Winston Group had a documented history of cigarette and fuel smuggling and alleged connections to illicit North Korean related commercial activities. Now the this report also has been able to find North Korea's shipping and maritime sanctions evasion tactics have become highly adaptive and are growing increasingly sophisticated in response to the pressure and enforcement by the international community. And this has complicated and increased the cost of illicit business in North Korea. And it surely has demonstrated the adaptability of North Korea's maritime trade networks and underscores the growing cost of monitoring, detection, and enforcement. Now, some of these very, now if you get all these points, it is important to consider that North Korea has been able to use different ways in which it is being able to access this kind of illicit oil and is being able to gain that amount of oil and violate oil sanctions. Now, what is important for the international community to understand is that if North Korea continues to evade such sanctions, and primarily if they violate oil sanctions, if the evidence and the proof of it lies right up in the open, and if there is no action, it will only encourage North Koreans to move forward. Now, for example, I mean, even if you consider the current negotiations the US is trying to conduct North Korea, the North Koreans aren't listening much, and they have, and they're continuing the nuclear tests, and it shows that there's a lot of aggression in the area at this particular point. But what the Biden administration must realize is, North Korea is actually, this point was also brought by Vladimir Putin, I believe, in 2017. Russian President Vladimir Putin actually said that the North Koreans have seen what's happened with Iraq, what's happened in Libya, and they aren't going to just, you know, just agree to any nuclear deal. There has to be some amount of surety on the American government. So you have to understand here that when Saddam Hussein said that he would give up his chemical weapons, the US came up with fabricated evidence that there was still chemical weapons, and investigators weren't being allowed to check the particular sites of Iraq, which led to the US invading Iraq. Although actually there has been a lot of proof which shows that whatever evidence was given in the UN Security Council back then was completely false and fabricated, frankly. Now, and then we look at Libya, where even Muammar Gaddafi had laid down his weapons and said that he would be ready for a peace deal. Even then, at the end, NATO intervened. The rebels went and killed him, and it was funded by the US. The rebels were funded by the US. And the, and even now, when 2015, the JCPOA was negotiated with Iran, just 3 years later, after the end, just 1 year after the a Republican president comes into being, there is the nuclear deal struck down, and there is a great amount of sanctions on Iran. And at this point, negotiations between the US and Iran are almost looking like two children fighting over a piece of cake or a chocolate, perhaps. Because, I mean, the way the US is negotiating with Iran is not the right way to move forward. I'll emphasize upon that later, but look at all of this. All each and every one of these factors just builds up to one thing: that North Korea should not be trusted in the US. It's clearly showing that the motive which the US is not wishing to negotiate in good faith in that for the North Koreans. Because let's realize this one thing: North Korea does not want a nuclear apocalypse. I believe that when the North Koreans brandish their weapons, show those weapons out in the open and conduct these tests, they are not a provocation. They're simply a sign to the international community that, look, don't mess with us. We will not be very nice. We will not be really soft in the way we negotiate. There will be hard terms, and there has to be a high amount of surety if a proper nuclear deal needs to be negotiated. And this clearly shows, and you know, these nuclear tests, and even North Koreans rejecting Biden's call, it clearly shows North Koreans are not having much faith in how the US is conducting its good, conducting the way its diplomacy as a whole. So right now, it's really important that the US set an example of how to negotiate. If the Biden administration really, really wants to begin a process by which they can allow North Korea to ensure its nuclear program gets restricted, because the North Koreans won't stop their nuclear program, there will have to be heavy restrictions for certain compromises, like dropping certain sanctions
perhaps even providing North Korea certain exemptions in international trade, or perhaps even trying to boost trade in North Korea. There has to be a number of ways, a compromise which the US and North Korea can reach in order to ensure negotiations can take place. Because look, the US hasn't been able to come at a proper base with any of its adversaries. For example, the recent Alaska summit between the US and China, a total disaster, because the US and China could not negotiate proper terms. Like, we need addressing issues like, for example, say the atrocities in Xinjiang, with the US even labeling it a genocide. There is actually legal proof which says that there is genocide being committed in Xinjiang. Moreover, even tensions in South China Sea and these certain, and even perhaps like these many issues have not been negotiated properly between the US and China. Right now in Ukraine, you can find a huge amount of fighting in Donbass region, with even Russian soldiers as many as 50,000 reaching a Donbass region, and the US and Russia have still not been able to cooperate. Rather, the Biden administration has just resorted to sanctions at the worst time possible. Because even, and this just shows that the US is not being able to conduct diplomacy yet. The Biden administration is still not showing that sign. Because even now there continues to be increasing tensions with different, with their adversaries. Even there have been a lot of problems regarding this very issue with diplomacy. Because US is now getting involved in a number of things at the same time. Be it the current in Ukraine, the Yemen, even the current situation with China, even trying to negotiate with the EU allies, trying to negotiate with Iran, and now we have North Korea as well. So the US needs to really figure out a way by which they can set certain examples which North Korea can see and then say, alright, let's give it a try. And the important thing is that here we can, North Koreans cannot be just persuaded by words or by just threats, like international action may be taken if you do not comply with certain rules and regulations. Because the fact is, let's face it, this report Black Gold clearly states one thing, that the North Koreans have understood how to adapt to sanctions and how to violate sanctions without the international community knowing anything, which just shows how complacent the international community has become. It is important that credibility be brought back into the system, and this report be used as all the findings be verified by governments, and then using these findings, there must be a way by which the UNSC can take proper action. Because now look, sanctions may have been agreed upon by China and Russia, but they won't go beyond that. So the US needs to find out a way by which they can directly speak to the North Koreans. And now, since you know, the Chinese government earlier, when the Biden administration just come into being, the Chinese government, the Chinese foreign ministry officials were very clearly worded. They said that we want better relations with the Americans and we want proper close ties, because Joe Biden back in when he was vice president, relations between Beijing and Washington were pretty okay, but there were certain disagreements, but there was also this mutual cooperation which existed, which completely broke down during the Donald Trump administration. And clearly the Biden administration is following the same roadmap, and clearly they have every justification to do so, considering the entire the types of atrocities committed by the Chinese government. Now, if the Americans and the Chinese government really wanted to work together, I would suggest two options. One, you worked on Myanmar and you ensure that you could together, in fact, try to target the military and negotiate with them to ensure a return of democracy in Myanmar, because you know it fulfills vital interests. Like, in one way you can say that the US is actually trying to get another country and keep it a democracy, and China is being just able to prevent another one of its possibly reliable allies from completely spiraling into chaos, sinful political chaos. And second, obviously, another very important part where the US and North Korea, where US and China could actually work together is North Korea, because the Chinese government has been helping North Korea and its economy ever since the Soviet Union collapsed, and you know the North Korea's reliance on Russia has dropped quite a lot more since the Russian Federation was formed in 1991, and the Chinese government is slowly involved in helping North Koreans. So it's important to even involve Beijing and try to figure out a common path and a compromise by which they can do it. It could mean certain exemptions, some sanctions, certain trade benefits, etc., etc. And but there needs to be a lot of cooperation among the parties to ensure that there is this conflict between the US and North Korea does not reach this instant where they both just follow the MAD theory. That is MAD, basically MAD meaning mutually assured destruction, where both parties just destroy each other. So we don't want that happening in North Korea and South Korea, but and not in North Korea and the US. And so there must be a common way, a compromise by which they can move on. So the US and Washington and Beijing need to work together on this very issue. And so it's important, because if these tensions continue, there will not be any way by which North Korean issue can be solved. So the US needs to first begin with setting examples. Like for example, it needs to get back in with the Iranians, with the JCPOA, and it needs to start engaging good diplomacy even with its adversaries like China and Russia. And then it needs to speak to Beijing and communicate to them that look, we have a certain areas where we cannot cooperate, but we can surely work on those if we do. For example, US climate and envoy John Kerry was able to get to Beijing to speak about climate. And so climate, actually, I mean, although the US itself is saying that even when we have certain things where we both lock horns, like for example economic coercion, or even perhaps the Xinjiang and the treatment of Uyghur Muslims, there are certain places where the Americans and the Chinese can in fact cooperate, and that has been climate has been one of them, and North Korea should also be one of them, because in that way both parties can actually benefit from the entire thing as a whole. So now that we've discussed Myanmar and North Korea, let's look at one of, or perhaps I would consider one of the most important players in Asia, that's the People's Republic of China. And first of all, there was a summit which took place in the US and China regarding the Washington's complete problems regarding the deep concerns, rather, regarding the activities in Xinjiang, Hong Kong and Taiwan. So, you know, in the situation in Hong Kong, it was led by protests and national security law, and now the People's Republic of China is clearly taking over the entire electric system of Hong Kong, and it's an entire overhaul of Hong Kong's electoral system. And these reforms will simply ensure that quote-unquote patriots to the Communist Party of China will be elected, because this clearly shows that China has now ensured that the entire electoral system of Hong Kong is completely extinguished, and therefore it is a big problem which now lies with the international community and especially with the US. And the another important point to consider which the US brought up was Taiwan. Now there have been reports that Taiwan that China has been sending military planes to Taiwan, fighter jets to Taiwan. Taiwan has been training its military to perhaps fight off these planes, and they have been successful so far. But many experts are actually fearing that Taiwan, like there could be a possible war between the US, between China and Taiwan. And primarily, even Taiwan itself says that, you know, you as the US or international community might have concerns that these will take years for a war, but we believe it will hardly take weeks or months. Now the fact of the matter is that that the People's Republic of China considers Taiwan to be a part of it. But however, if you look at 1949, I believe when Mao Zedong actually took over the People's Republic of China, Taiwan clearly, the Taiwanese nationals, they occupied one island which is now called Taiwan. And Taiwan has grown to develop this diversity, this one identity, which the Taiwanese identity, which is now developed in the island, and it clearly shows that right now it is ready to be integrated into the international community. For example, Taiwan's very handling of the COVID-19 crisis was highly efficient, actually. Got many of people thinking that why don't we get Taiwan on a WHO, but it's not possible because Taiwan is not a member of the UN. It was the General Assembly resolution prevented Taiwan from being a member of the UN, and now with the PRC now having hold upon a Security Council, there is hardly any hope of Taiwan being a member of the UN. Moreover, the US really does not, even the US actually supplies arms and weapons to the Taiwanese. They don't really have quote unquote diplomatic foreign, like diplomatic relations, like embassies, etc. Although many high level officials have gone to Taiwan to visit it, there have been hardly any kind of diplomatic ties, because there is this one China policy which the US has been in following all this while long. And many lawmakers actually have been saying that, you know, why should we continue with this one China policy? Why can't we consider the People's Republic of China, represented by Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party, and we have the Republic of China, which is right now governed and will be represented by President Taipei. And there have been number of talks regarding this, but however, still there does not seem to be any kind of law which right now would in fact establish diplomatic relations between the US and Taiwan, because it would actually have lots of implication in future. For example, China actually has like had lots of issues with any kind of coverage written in Taiwan, etc. Because I was watching this interview with the Taiwanese foreign minister on WION, World is One News, and China wrote a big letter regarding their concerns about WION having that meet with the Taiwanese foreign minister and an interview. And you know, it just shows that the Chinese government is clearly not wanting any kind of relations, any kind of country to have its relations with Taiwan anyways. And even Czechoslovakia, some Czechoslovakian officials once had visited Taiwan, and the Chinese government really had lots of issues with those. And it really shows that China doesn't want the world to be there with Taiwan. And so the military confrontation which might exist between the Chinese and the Taiwanese, what it has got people thinking is, will, in case, in the event of a military confrontation with Taiwan, will the US militarily intervene against the Chinese government? Now, when you talk about a military intervention of this level, you're talking about two major superpowers, right? Let's take it. Although China may have gone through a rough time during Mao Zedong's reign back in the 20th century, but now China really has grown with its huge consumer market and the consumers, huge number of consumers, its market, its economy has been booming even post-COVID. And it clearly shows that China is now going to be a very big superpower and a potential superpower, with even its army being the largest, I believe. And so it shows that the US now needs to see China as one of its prime adversaries. Although Russia has been in fact leading some of some efforts in cyber warfare, there one of the important consideration of China is also China, because China is the economic adversary of the US, and it also China has been a very big adversary of India as well, which happens to be not one of its treaty allies, but one of the Americans' allies, in the sense that, you know, the India and the US have had great relations in the past. There have been negotiations for nuclear deals back in 2005. There was even the India is part of the Quad Atlantic Security Dialogue, or QSD, and it continues to lead efforts with the US against China. So if you're talking about considering Taiwan, India's relation with Taiwan are also a bit complicated in that way, because actually not many major countries consider Taiwan to be an independent country. Even if you actually look at an India-Taiwan relations as a whole, India doesn't have a diplomatic relation as such, but there have been close relations between India and Taiwan. And you know, this has also been perhaps a way by which India has try to even go against China, because you know, by essentially if India were to in fact engage diplomatic ties with Taiwan, China would be highly enraged. This would perhaps even increase tension between both the countries. But have we actually looked at what perhaps international law was, perhaps what a convention would actually say? So if you want to look at international law convention, for example, let's have a look at the Montevideo Convention. This Montevideo Convention on the Rights and Duties of States. Let's look primarily at Article 1 of the Montevideo Convention, which states that as a person of international law should possess the following qualifications: a permanent population. Unless Taiwan in fact has a permanent population, there has been, if you look at the entire demographic of Taiwan, it clearly shows that now there is not a Chinese population but a Taiwanese population which has turned out to be in Taiwan. Second, a defined territory. Let's realize Taiwan has an island territory which is clearly defined, and see a government which has been elected democratically. We have seen that in Taiwan, President Tsai Ing-wen, her party was elected as the new government. So, and fourth is the capacity to enter relations with other states. And the although Taiwan doesn't have diplomatic relations with major countries, it really does have ties, it does have those diplomatic relations with and countries actually recognize the recognize Taiwan as the ROC, or Republic of China, which is like countries like Guatemala, Honduras, Haiti, Paraguay. And then if you look at Taiwan as a whole, its foreign ties, it has certain ties, substantial ties with countries like Australia, Canada, even the EU nations, Japan, New Zealand. And so if you go by legal terms of the Montreal Convention, it clearly shows that Taiwan can actually be regarded as a state. Now, however, the only issue that comes behind this is that the 16 states that have ratified this convention are primarily related to the Americas. That's and only perhaps the only major country to have actually major power to have ratified a convention is the United States, not China and other countries. So it's very difficult for us to for the international law, the Montreal Convention, to be imposed on Taiwan and considered, and according to the Montreal Convention, considered to be a state under the Montreal Convention definition of a state. But nevertheless, it's important to consider that Taiwan has been also been an important power in the geopolitics in the world so far, and China making a big thing out of it clearly shows that China is does not like the amount of publicity that Taiwan is getting at this particular point. Now, if you look at, for example, the China's action in Xinjiang, the activities in Xinjiang are particularly very concerning, and the government calls them re-education camps, which are holding the Uyghur Muslims. But these alleged human rights violations have made the US and even the Canadian parliament call it a genocide. So let's have a look at what's really happening in Xinjiang. And you know, for this actually I have started writing a blog. Since the podcast was not taking place for quite some time, we had decided to start a blog, and we actually posted 3 new articles, one on the Myanmar coup, the second being on the Jamal Khashoggi report, which has just been released by the US government, and then third also about the activities of the Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. I'll be giving the link in the description, so like check it out. The blog is really amazing, and we are getting new content. We are trying it weekly. We'll try getting new content every single week. And so yeah, so speaking about this very Uyghur Muslim situation in Xinjiang, there have been a number of terrorism threats and anti-secessionist or secessionist threats which have existed in Xinjiang back in 2014, and you'll actually find that there has been a lot of problems regarding this terrorist threat. Now, however, the very activities which the Chinese government has been involved in, clearly it has been able to clamp down on a terrorist threat. However, it is now beginning to violate human rights. And I had written a New York Times article of it clearly shows a 400 page document giving a guideline to each and every authority in Xinjiang that you gotta speak this way. When a Chinese government talks to you, it basically provides a diplomatic and calm and even authoritative tone to which these officials speak to concerned citizens or concerned children who have their parents or relatives all locked up in prison for perhaps no reason at all. And now, wait, so considering this very issue, there have been a number of reports of surveillance as well. I mean, if you consider the Human Rights Watch reports, there has been a lot of research which shows that Xinjiang police are using illegally gathered information about people's completely lawful behavior and using it against them. And the Chinese government is actually monitoring every aspect of people's lives in Xinjiang and picking out those in mistrust and subjecting them to extra scrutiny. Now, the fact is that each and every one of these claims are coming in, and now it obviously begs the question, why the massive surveillance, why the increased security, why the immense amount of police presence, why the sophisticated surveillance system? It clearly, there's a reason behind it. That is the Belt and Road Initiative, which actually goes to Xinjiang, and this BRI, which is the economic and diplomatic weapon of the Chinese government, has been going through Xinjiang. And But you know, if you look at Xinjiang's resources, it provides an oil gas resources as well as it provides 1/5 of the world's cotton, so it is quite resourceful, and that and a BRI also the therefore will flow through it. Now, but one thing does in fact come into being, and this point was brought up in an Al Jazeera Start Here video by Sophie Richardson, the China director of the Human Rights Watch, and she said that I think the Chinese government has used the Belt and Road Initiative to justify a need for heightened security. Now, this statement actually makes sense because if you look at it, BRI is a very important piece of diplomatic weapon for China. It's important because it has used the BRI to advance relations to even economically annex countries, annex certain parts of countries, for example, like Sri Lanka. And it shows that the BRI is very important for China. So it would actually say that, you know, we have this Uyghur terrorist threat. How do you possibly, so are you like saying that because we should ignore the terrorist threat and simply go ahead with such an important economic plan like the BRI just without any security measures? Well, the thing is that, you know, even if you look at Sophie Richardson even stated this, that we should be clear, there have been violent attacks occasionally by small groups of people in the region, but there is little to no credible evidence that could in any way justify the kind of policy that we see. So, you know, if you look at how terrorist threats took place back in 2014, it clearly shows that there was a huge threat. But now China has been able to, in a tactical manner, been able to crack down on these terrorist threats, and now it is almost like they're nullified, because now you do not hear that Uyghur Muslims going out and bombing cars. You couldn't hear that right now, do you? So the Chinese government clearly is either it is becoming too obsessed with the entire situation in Xinjiang, and it simply considers Uyghur Muslims to be a complete threat to China's security. Or it could also mean perhaps a different thing, and China is now trying to slowly and gradually destroy Islam in China, which is one very big looming threat which exists today because of these activities by the Chinese government. So if you still look at the fact that the US is called a genocide, let us have a good look at why is it being called a genocide. So the Convention on Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide was approved and proposed for ratification, and China has ratified the convention. It was signed by the Republic of China back when it was presented at the UN, but it was actually ratified by the PRC. So a convention becomes legally binding to a particular state when the state ratifies it. So, you know, if you look at Article 1 of the convention, it clearly makes genocide a crime, be it in peace or time of war. So even if China were, for example, claiming that we are having a war on terror or something like that, it does not hold good. So even now, if you look at genocide, the current definition of it would mean killing members of a group, causing seriously bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life, calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole and part, imposing measures intended to prevent births in the group, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. It clearly, all of these reports do in fact actually match, because look at reports which shows that China has been using sterilization, forced sterilization programs, mass abortions, even use of intrauterine devices, IUDs, and these have been carried out on the Uyghur Muslims to prevent births. Even the PRC has been involved in direct and public incitement to genocide, because if you find the way the speeches have been made by various officials in Xinjiang, even President Xi Jinping, certain speeches of his did in fact say that there was a requirement for a response as good as 9/11 war on terror. Let's realize the Uyghur Muslim threat may have been really serious, but to equate something with 9/11 is a totally different thing altogether. 9/11 was a culmination of events. It was not just one year which when Al Qaeda decided to attack New York. It's not that. It was a culmination of events of what happened with Al Shabaab in Somalia and Kenya, and all of these things, and a lapse in security measures because of the 2000 election between Al Gore and George W. Bush, which had made the US this vulnerable to such a big attack by the Al Qaeda. And frankly, if we're talking about what happened after 9/11, I mean, what's there to add? I mean, there was a whole war on terror, and a war in Afghanistan, which is seeing certain hope of becoming a bit better there than the US invasion of Iraq. You saw Even the Department of Homeland Security, the Patriot Act, and these kind of laws to come into being. And all these clearly show that 9/11 had a drastic impact on the world in which we live right now. Geopolitics, or even the way in which America or other countries handle terrorism, has been clearly seen as a model from 9/11. So if you look at 9/11, such a vast coordinated activities of terrorists, and then you compare it with simple violence from the Uyghur Muslims, it doesn't justify anything, and it cannot be equated with 9/11. It clearly shows the Chinese government is directly attacking members of a particular religion. And this even goes, even if you look at the genocide definition given Article 7 of the Rome Statute of the ICC, it actually gives a much wider definition of genocide. For example, stuff like extermination, enslavement, even deportation, imprisonment or other sleep deprivation, physical liberty, and torture, rape, etc. All of these do in fact give a much wider detail to the genocide definition, and all of these have been committed by the Chinese government. Now the Uyghur Muslims have obviously asked the ICC to ensure that, you know, these crimes are prosecuted, because see, the ICC does in fact, you know, they do in fact prosecute individuals, but they cannot do that in the case of China, because the PRC is clearly not ratified the Rome Statute of the ICC, and it's pretty obvious that any resolution, like for example, consider the situation in Darfur, where the Security Council resolution clearly recommended Darfur genocide in Sudan to be recommended to the ICC. Here that cannot happen, because here we are very well aware that China will not allow their own officials to be prosecuted, and so they will not allow this to go to ICC, and therefore there's no way in which the ICC has jurisdiction in China, and thus cannot take, and thus the ICC cannot take any action when it comes to genocide crimes against humanity being committed in Beijing, in Xinjiang, sorry. And so the very point to be made here is that the US, if it really wants to counter China when it comes to the Uyghur Muslim threat, it needs to mobilize certain of its recent allies. For example, the US needs to work with countries like India, which where in India and the US share a common enemy, that is China, and that is pretty much understandable from every point of view. And it does show that the US and China are not king horns in this way. If the US needs to hold China accountable, there needs to be a clear system to do so. The Quad must be much more strengthened, the quadrilateral security dialogue. The Quad must be strengthened further. India and Japan, both countries which have economies large enough to tackle America, or even South Korea and Japan, which in fact have a very flourishing economies, India, which is militarily powerful, if these countries could be aided, could be helped out, then it just shows that it would be able to pressurize the Chinese government. The Chinese government has been engaging in negotiations with the UN Secretary General regarding a UN investigation, independent UN investigation in Xinjiang. And you know, frankly, I see the Chinese government foreign minister officials coming out and ranting and saying that and calling reports fake, like BBC reports fake, when BBC actually says that the things they are quoting in the Chinese foreign ministry, we don't even know what they are. We don't even know what they're quoting, we don't understand who all they're quoting to prove our reports are wrong. Then even the way in which Chinese foreign ministry officials today, the way they speak, it is completely different from what it was 5 years ago. 5 years ago, China was much more diplomatic, or perhaps like a courtesy diplomatic of sorts, you know. We don't add that directly. We say that, yes, we have serious concerns regarding this, or if you're denying a certain accusation, even then we say that we completely deny because there is no evidence to prove that, or that we have evidence which proves that whatever the international community or whatever someone else is saying is wrong. So that is the way in which diplomacy continues in the or is supposed to continue in the international sphere. But right now we find China in a much more polarized way, with the language being used by the foreign ministry officials much more undiplomatic than usual, with even the media also has been calling these foreign ministry officials wolf warriors, and it shows. So I mean, even this kind of language being, even if you look at how the US China Alaska summit went on, it was really extreme, the most direct or perhaps the most blunt and undiplomatic conversation which could stoke up Cold War like tensions. So, you know, looking at all of this, it's important to understand that right now the Quad needs to be assembled as an important part. So the Quad is being regarded as one alliance which can actually tackle China. So it needs to take that up as a big issue, because the US and China have a number of disagreements, be it the South China Sea dispute, Xinjiang, or even this economic coercion to the BRI and other important parts of cyber security, etc. So it is important right now at this measure that the US and the Quad, countries like India, South Korea, Japan, Australia, they work together to ensure that there is this coordinated effort to address the Chinese threat. Because countries like India, which can militarily pressure the Chinese, even like at least there should be enough pressure to make the Chinese government have an independent UN investigation. But then again, the number of loopholes when it comes to a UN investigation. We do not know how biased the UN investigators might be, how independent they can be, if there won't be efforts for Chinese government to hide certain facts, on the ground facts. They would, I mean, it's not possible to hide everything, obviously, but there will be certain levels, certain amounts to which they will go to hide evidence. So there has to be a way in which China is held accountable, and that is, for now at least, it looks like an independent investigation is the only way forward. And the Quad must keep China on its toes. The Quad must address this threat of China, because India, Japan, Australia, they all have these security threats from China. Japan is minimal, but Australia, ever since the rant on social media between Australia and China, and even trade collapsing between both countries, there is a bit of problems regarding that. Even India and China regarding the LSE issue, and even this rush to vaccine diplomacy, where India and China are also competing like that, and the US and China obviously going to this extent, when both countries are now using blunt language against each other. So it's a pretty big problem to consider for the US at this particular point. So the US, for once, when it came to Xinjiang, they coordinated sanctions against officials. So it's a beginning, it's a start to show that the US is leading coordinated efforts, and that it will help in bearing fruit. So thank you very much for listening in. And so now we come to India, which is also along with China another very important major player in Asia perhaps. And considering there have been two important visits which have taken place in India so far, visits to the Bangladesh, even visits from climate envoy John Kerry, even Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov also visited New Delhi. And some of these important visits actually sum up what India's relations in different parts of the world look like. First of all, let's have a look at the Prime Minister Narendra Modi's visit to Bangladesh, where the two sides signed 5 memorandums of understanding that covered disaster management and mitigation, establishment of a framework for cooperation and trade remedial measures, even sports facilities and cooperation between the cadet corps as well as cadet corps, and the supply of ICT equipment, reference books and trainings for the Bangladesh Bharat Digital Service and Employment Training Center. So primarily lots of parts in which both the countries are now cooperating at this particular time. And what's important to consider is the fact that even earlier, as I mentioned, countries like Myanmar were caught in the India-China foreign policy advancement initiatives. The same way, when Bangladesh itself also found itself in these foreign policy initiatives, because even China wanted to begin a number of BRI projects with Bangladesh, which in turn had caused a number of problems with New Delhi. And now, considering that India and Bangladesh have once again, they have been able to strengthen their relations further, strengthen their trade relations, and not to mention that even India handed over about 109 ambulances, even donated 1.2 million doses of COVID-19 vaccines as a grant. It clearly shows that India and Bangladesh are clearly working together on the COVID-19 pandemic, also on trade-related issues. But another extremely important point where India and Bangladesh need to work upon is the Rohingya refugees, because there have been a lot of allegations raised by the Indian government that refugees are being able to easily infiltrate to the border. And so the India and Bangladesh need to work on their border security if they need to help contain the entry of Rohingya refugees in India, or perhaps the over-entry, perhaps we will call it. And this has been a problem between Dhaka and New Delhi for quite some time. And so, but how the main point here is, if you look at how India has now been advancing its vaccine diplomacy, it's been trying to get number of the neighbors, number of its neighbors to ally with them and not with China, which has been a big issue ever since June 2020 LAC intrusion between by China. And this clearly shows that right now India is getting completely ready in its foreign policy to get as many allied countries against China. Now there's another important part to consider is the Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov's visit here in India. And he actually visited here at the same time as the US climate envoy John Kerry, and both actually met as well. Now it seems that there, like, media reports do in fact claim that in addition to climate, they possibly discuss the Iran nuclear deal. Now the thing is that there is a possibility is happening, because if you look at like John Kerry, before he was US climate envoy, he was US Secretary of State during President Obama's rule, and then John Kerry primarily was one of the key negotiators of the JCPOA with Iran, and it clearly shows that and therefore it would be pretty obvious that John Kerry and Sergey Lavrov would be discussing the Iran nuclear deal, considering that it has been one of the key highlights of this entire issue with the US is having with Iran and the Middle East and with Iran's nuclear weapons program, considering that Iran is now enriching its uranium by a huge percentage ever since the Natanz facility attack. And therefore, it would show that even the US and Russia, despite their differences, do in fact have these common grounds where they can work together, like Iran. And so, and also one more thing to consider here is the fact that about India-Russia relations. Ever since the Russian government had declared that there would be a purchase of the S-400 surface-to-air missile system being purchased by India, there have been number of concerns in the US, where there have been number of concerns raised regarding this purchase by India, considering India also is not a treaty ally of the US, but it continues to be in alliances with the US, like for example the Quad, or even a nuclear deal which was negotiated between the US and the Indians, and even back in 2005. And now the Quad alliance is also an important bloc right in the Indo-Pacific. So considering this very important point that Russia-India relations have always, they've gone back to the old ages, and there was this, now let me explain a policy which India has followed for years. So the first Prime Minister of India, Jawaharlal Nehru, had brought up this movement known as the Non-Aligned Movement, because in 1947, when by the time India already got an independence, the Cold War had begun between the Soviet Union and the United States. And there were two blocks from the NATO and the Warsaw Pact, which in turn resulted in a number of confrontation between them, not direct but proxy confrontations, which was pretty much destabilizing to international peace and security. So India had led this initiative wherein they were able to mediate between the Americans and the Soviets. And this one policy has been followed by administration after administration, except that right now the current government in India seems to be inclining a bit towards the West, or at least that is Russia's perception of how India has been operating. Because in the US, a number of the military officials have been saying that in order to prevent India from buying Russian weapons, sanctions is not an option they would consider. Rather, it would be to encourage the Indian government to buy American weapons. Because frankly, if you look at it, if America were to impose sanctions on Russia, on India for its purchase of Russian weapons, India would not accept it lightly, because India is a sovereign country and they aren't even a treaty ally of the US, which does not make them completely legally binding to every single thing that the US says. And so the American government would risk losing a very important ally, because I mean, let's understand one thing. I mean, in global diplomacy, there is a saying that goes, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So the same way, America and India have a common enemy, that is China. So without India, America will find it extremely difficult to counter China economically and militarily in that way. So they require the Indian government to also be on the side. So so that's why it's important at this point to look at how things have been flowing between the alliance between the US and India. Now the problem has been that Russia has been having certain concerns regarding India's alliances. Like for example, Sergey Lavrov made this made this entire reference to Asia Pacific block and expressed number of concern, the cerebral spider man and the China block, and it was clearly not acceptable. And this is pretty obvious considering that China and Russia recently held a summit, the foreign ministers of both countries held a summit to discuss how they were going to approach their relations. They were bolstering their relations, even attempts to ensure that they can counter the US. And so the Quad Alliance clearly seems to be another roadblock in all of this. And the complication is that India is a member of the Quad Alliance. And therefore, the point is that even India has this has a problem with Moscow having such good relation to Beijing. Because, but however, one point is that when it came to the June 2020 standoff between India and China, Russia decided to mediate, and they even held talks in Moscow to mediate between the parties and to continue talks because Russia really did not want to get into it, and they blamed it all on Asia Pacific, on the Asian Pacific or Indo-Pacific drills which are taking place. And it clearly shows that Russia doesn't want to jeopardize its relations with India, but at the same time it has serious concerns about India's approaching its own foreign policy regarding Beijing. Because let's understand one thing, that Russia itself would not want to completely complicate its relation in India, because for Russia, India is a prime buyer of all their weapons. So Russia would have to give in and try to reach a compromise with the Indian government. But right now, the way the Indian government needs to proceed is one which follows a non-alignment policy, which is brought back in the Cold War. We need to ensure that we can remember that the NAM, the non-aligned movement, is followed, because if we continue to appease the West to a great extent, we would end up actually losing a strategic ally like Russia, because India would be ending up losing a strategic ally like Russia. Because let's face it, Russia's weapons are also highly advanced, and certain American weapons may have prices which are not affordable enough by the Indian government, or perhaps too pricey for the Indian government to buy in bulk, which is becoming a big issue. So if the American government really wants to even sell those weapons at significantly lower prices, even I would myself suggest that the Indian government not go ahead with it, because the fact is that India has had its relations with US and Russia both intact. But there has to be the way to maintain that non-alignment policy is to ensure that they can work with both countries on common issues. So Another thing Russia did, which was perhaps one which angered New Delhi to a great extent, was the fact that Russia, their foreign minister Sergey Lavrov, also traveled to Pakistan exactly after the Indian visit, which clearly shows that Pakistan has been an adversary of the Indians, and it has, the polarization has just increased further more, and it has made India completely intolerant to Pakistan. And that in fact has resulted in both having very vulnerable ties. Although Pakistani generals have in fact stated that they want better relations with the Indian government, there are certain things that are not adding up in that very equation, in that very relations. So Sergey Lavrov's visit to Islamabad clearly shows that there is a certain, it could either be the Russians would clarify, rather it would be best to Russians to provide a clarification that look, we say, because look, we understand one thing, Pakistan is also a big part of the Afghanistan crisis. The crisis existing there because the Taliban have now, the US is saying it's going to withdraw troops by September 11. The Taliban is also, number of reports show that the Taliban is in fact possibly going to team up Al Qaeda again to take up Afghanistan. And so it is important right now the Russians negotiate with the Pakistanis, because the Pakistani government has been in fact quite a number of times accused for having funded terrorist organizations, even those linked to the Taliban, which makes Pakistan an important player in the Afghanistan crisis. And so either it could be the Russians went for that reason, or it could be a way of perhaps spitting India in the face, which will show that Russia is actually now getting more polarized with Beijing. Now, if you look at our foreign policy view of Russia in this instance, Russia and the Soviets have always kept good relations in India. We have had good relations with Russians. There have been good ties. They have been primarily military, primarily transactional in nature. And the one problem which I guess both India and Russia are having with each other is China, because India has a completely anti-China view, and they have joined a completely anti-China alliance with the Quad. And Russia, on the other hand, has good relations with Beijing and actually strengthening them even further. However, still it's important to consider the fact that strategically speaking, India must not lose someone in Russia, and Russia must not do the same. Must not do the same, because if Russia ends up losing India, they lose a very important ally, in the sense that they would lose a major arms buyer. And in that way, India will then be further polarized to the West, and it will completely depend upon the West for everything, right? Which will make it as equal to a pawn of the West. Now, considering India since 1947 has in fact posed as a country which is rather different from all of them, from either the West or the Russians, it clearly shows that this kind of policy would mean that India needs to itself try to come out as a country mediating between both the sides, and through common agendas, through common finding common points of agreement, and accordingly moving forward. So speaking about, like earlier I had stated about India-Pakistan ties, that Pakistan has been a great adversary of India for quite some time, and there have been, and you know, for the past number of years, the amount of polarization in both countries is related in India-Pakistan ties going down by great extent. But still, there have been certain good advancements in that policy, because right now we found a number of Pakistani generals actually claiming that there should be a cordial relations with the Indian government, that there should be an improvement in those relations. Even Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi reportedly sent Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan a letter saying that India wants cordial relations with Pakistan, and these are actually coming among bilateral talks on water sharing. Now the important part is, look, the Indians would want, in fact, a good relationship with Pakistan. Rather, they would be able to engage in better trade, provide a number of business to different traders existing across the border. But there has been a lot of issues regarding this. The Kashmir dispute is one of them. But the most important of all of them has obviously been the fact that Pakistan has been a state sponsor of terrorism. It continues to be in the FATF grey list regarding the fact that it has in fact funded terror organizations which have conducted terror attacks in Kashmir, in India itself. And men have been the Jaish-e Mohammed, even the Taliban, and even number of reports also claim that they have been funding Al-Qaeda as well, which is a big problem. So the only way in which I can actually see the Indian government would be ready to completely normalize relations with Pakistan, in the sense that they would reduce the polarization or reduce the amount of heatedness in the entire relations, they would rather ensure that there is a common way in which both the parties can move forward. Because let's understand another thing. Pakistan is usually regarded as a puppet of China, because Pakistan's economy is one which is in a very bad state, and it continues to still support terror organizations. Now it is pretty obvious, its funds come from some country, and that country we all know is the People's Republic of China, which continues to support Pakistan. But and Pakistan has been delaying its payments under the BRI to China, and that's how bad its economy is doing. And so I believe the Indian government, the only way we can actually see relations between both the countries doing good is if Pakistan stops its terror funding. As much as obviously Indian government will have its share of skepticism regarding Pakistan's history, even Pakistan's relation with China, the Indian government will have a share of skepticism. However, completely banning any kind of funding for terrorist organization or housing terrorists, that would be a big start to Pakistan, because Pakistan has been facing sanctions from a number of countries, including EU, for its funding of terrorist organizations and even providing refuge to terrorists, which has actually been a big issue entirely, and it has been one surrounding the Indian-Pakistani relationship as well. Therefore, a good way to start off with the relations is by reducing this funding or actually completely eliminating this terror organization funding, because we are seeing on the Indian government side there is a want for a better talks, very diplomatic way of handling these relations, same as Pakistan. And so it's important right now that both countries, if they want to start off on a good note, the best note for Pakistan to begin with this is if Pakistan stops funding terrorist organizations responsible for killing Indians in Kashmir, for killing so many people across the globe, which is a big issue.
So I'd like to end the episode with one important event that's been taking place. That's the conflict in Ukraine so far. Don't worry, we'll be coming up with much more content. We've got a lot of stuff to cover in the Middle East as well. I'll begin that the next episode. But we're going to end this right now because this is something which we need to address at this particular moment. Because right now, reports have been suggesting that whatever has been going on in Ukraine, even the breakdown in US-Russia relations is resulting in a war-like situation in Ukraine. So first of all, to give some background on the conflict. So primarily back in 2014, when there was this annexation of Crimea, which took place, the Crimean Peninsula, which was actually annexed by Russia in an illegal manner, a referendum was conducted which completely violated the sovereignty and of Ukraine, and clearly it was completely conducted in a manner which shows that the referendum is not it is not valid. Primarily, so therefore a number of countries actually criticized the entire annexation as a whole. So even like this was a great topic of debate and debate topic in the UN as well. The UN General Assembly Resolution 60/262 entitled Territorial Integrity of Ukraine, which was a non-binding resolution. It was supported by 100 UN member states that affirmed the GS commitment to the territorial integrity of Ukraine, and it even underscored the invalidated 2014 Crimean referendum. And so the fact of the matter right now has been, and this has been a point again for US-Russia relations, because where a number of breakdown took place, a lot of sanctions were imposed, and it came up to be, and this was one of the annexation conducted by countries ever since World War II, which is a big concern for the international community. There was a huge military buildup back then in Crimea, and that had resulted in that particular annexation taking place because of this illegal referendum conducted. Now, in US-Russia relations, if you see it, Russia has been a very key point of foreign policy for the US in ways of in the political discussion in back in the US as well, because Joe Biden and Donald Trump actually both came at a point where Biden obviously claimed that Trump wasn't that was harsh against Putin's actions in the US elections, and when Putin's hacking into the US election of Russia. So there have been lots of issues regarding that. For example, a US intelligence report clearly assessed that the 2020 elections were hacked primarily by the Russians. There were a number of attempts actually by the Russians to hack the elections. And back in 2016 also, there was a great amount of proof which shows that even Russia had in fact used a number of methods to hack into US elections, even used social media as a way of polarizing voters and thus turning it towards the Republican side. And therefore now the US, there have also been reports by the CIA, an CIA assessment that Russia paid bounties to kill American troops in Afghanistan. And they paid bounties to Taliban, which in turn shows that Russia also has a hand in terrorist funding. But now recently, number of military agencies actually have spoken about this, and they have said that there is perhaps little to moderate confidence that the report is completely right and accurate. However, they're still reviewing it and they're still looking into whether or not they actually do in fact coincide, they actually are verified and valid. So there is a Joe Biden administration at this point, it has announced a series of new measures which include financial sanctions, expulsion of diplomats, and even the SolarWinds hack, which resulted in hacking a number of companies, even a number of US agencies, clearly shows that right now at this point where warfare has now evolved from the ground to computers. Cyber warfare has developed as a huge discussion in the international community. Even when the US-China-Alaska summit took place, one of the important things was China's cyber warfare capabilities. And this shows that cyber warfare has been a big issue, because even North Korea has been responsible for conducting cyber warfare tactics. Russia itself also has been responsible. And this clearly shows that cyber warfare is now the new method of warfare which we followed. First there was on the ground direct warfare, and then proxy warfare, and now we have cyber warfare. And this will continue in different ways and different measures, and it is said to develop pretty fast. Now let's look at, and this also clearly shows that the US has not got its cyber security right, because if you are being hacked by hackers in Russia, clearly shows the US is not being able to maintain its own cyber security sphere. So it has to work much more in order to ensure development of the cyber security sphere for American government agencies.
Now, if we look clearly at what the new sanctions do, they prohibit US banks from buying any new Russian government bonds. It also, they have sanctioned 32 individuals and entities over alleged attempts to influence 2020 election and expelled 10 Russian diplomats. Even it also accused Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service of carrying out, it formally accused them of carrying out the SolarWinds hack and considered to be one of the world's largest cyber intrusions, and it targeted US government and corporate computer networks. Now the penalties have also been, now the penalties have been brought for many of these reasons, and this shows that the Biden administration has been in fact taking a very harsh step towards Russia. However, I believe that this action taken by the Americans against the Russians is at a very bad time, because I've obviously listened to the fact that I have mentioned the Ukraine conflict first, right? So if you look at what time of sanctions are, it's during a time when US-Russia relations need to be at its best, because if you look at Ukraine right now, where there has been increased fighting in Donbass region with even a number of reports suggesting 50,000 Russian troops in present in Donbass and even different annexed areas of Ukraine, like as a tanks, artillery near Ukraine's eastern border, and there has been a lot of issue regarding how Russia has been deploying its troops. Ukraine itself has been continuously asking NATO to accept it in its military alliance. Now there have been still talks regarding that, and at this point when the US and Russia need to work together and ensure a de-escalation in the region, we are rather than seeing possibly another escalation in the region caused due to America's actions. Like, if you look at the fact that right now Russia has been advancing in this way, Russia continues to say that there is no issue, there is nothing to worry about, because right now Russia is simply conducting military exercises. But when you send 50,000 troops, it's not just a military exercise, not to mention it, the separatist forces working in the Donbass region against the Ukrainian government, which then again clearly indicates, you know, there is a certain amount of level which Russia could possibly be looking towards another annexation as well. Plus, let's also remember one more thing. When you talk about Ukraine entering into NATO, NATO has been really, really, really trying to be diplomatic regarding this, because Russia has said if Ukraine enters NATO, that is a red line. And actually, it was a number of reports suggesting Ukraine entering into NATO, which provoked the Russians to annex Crimea as a way of saying that, you know, if you try this, we will go for military action. And now one important part which actually is considered here is Article 5 of the NATO Treaty, which is something which is has been the main spotlight of the NATO Treaty as a whole. Because Article 5 clearly states that if one country of NATO is attacked, then all other NATO countries will come together to defend it. It's basically collective self-defense, as stated under Article 51 of the UN Charter. So in that way, what happens is that if Russia were to say, get into some argument for Ukraine, resulting in a military confrontation, Russia will not only be facing Ukraine, they'll be facing the entire NATO alliance, starting with the US, the UK, France, Germany, etc. And it goes on and on, which would be a huge issue for Russia, which in turn would ensure that Russia has a big problem for Russia as well. And so many countries in NATO have been really, really careful as to how they proceed with Russia regarding this issue of applying Ukraine to the NATO alliance. Now, when you look at what sanctions have been imposed by the Americans against the Russians themselves have also imposed travel bans against number of high military officials, like even the Director of Homeland Security and even former ambassador to UN, US ambassador to UN Susan Rice, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, and many others who were quote unquote responsible for framing a very anti-Russia policy in America. Because I've been very vocal against Russian activities, and it clearly shows that Russia right now usually these asset bans, these travel, that is sanctions, all of these usually take place rather in the, they get hidden in the spotlight, and they don't really take place in an open manner. But this time Moscow, the Kremlin actually has done this in a very open manner, which shows that Russia is slowly becoming all the more frustrated with America. And the fact is that Russia is being able to do this for one reason again, that is they have an ally, China. China continues to be a, again, remember earlier in the episode I had told you all about the fact that Russia and China have good relations and they have been working together to look into how they can handle the US, and the way in which this entire relations between America and Russia have been forming, it clearly shows that Russia wants to tell the US that look, we aren't gonna back down because we have someone who can challenge you, so don't try challenging us as well. Because we can see that Moscow actually retaliating in some of the most decisive ways in this way, and therefore and frankly the US sanctions, it could have come at a different time, or it could have come earlier, not during a time when the US and Russia literally need to negotiate. Not to mention that even Biden himself says that let's just hope for good relations, despite just imposing sweeping sanctions and clearly making lots of economic restrictions for individuals and Russian government as well. Because you know, it again shows that this is becoming yet another problem, because perhaps US sanctions are just becoming another part of America's way of domestic politics. That because Biden wants to show that he is tough on Russia, that he considers Russia as number one threat, he is imposing sanctions, that's a good thing. But what is to be understood in diplomatic terms, it needs to be an understanding of the fact that right now the US and Russia really, really need to work together on this thing in Ukraine. And if the more the US does this to polarize relations between them and Russia, it will just result in all the more problems for both the countries. And definitely Biden needs to figure out a way, President Biden needs to figure out a way in which they can get the Russians at the table and they can work together in Ukraine. Because if the Donbas conflict goes into a full-blown war, you could find the US and other countries also intervening. Not to mention that Turkey as well has actually stated it to support Ukraine. And this shows clearly that there is a lot of an issue going on between all the countries involved right here. And because Turkey has been having some problems with the US regarding the S-400 purchases. They purchased the S-400 system from Russia. Being a NATO ally, they have this moral obligation on dealing with Russia, and that has brought Turkey-US relation at a very big low. But Turkey-Ukraine relation has been at a good pace with the number of drone purchases by Ukraine and so on and so forth, number of trade cooperation, etc. And it clearly shows that Ankara is now going to face off against Moscow when it comes to Ukraine. And that again shows that Ankara and Moscow, although they might have a transactional relationship, they might have very military ties and that sort, they do in fact not agree on a number of issues like Libya, like Syria, and now like Ukraine. And even in Nagorno-Karabakh issue as well. So even at this point, you find other countries like Germany, etc., so showing a lot of concern regarding this. Even Macron, President Emmanuel Macron of France, Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany, even Ukraine's President Zelensky have all been pressing Russia to completely take down its military action and try to de-escalate the situation in the region, because it cannot go into full-scale war. But I believe that the way in which Russians are advancing, it clearly shows that they need that they will negotiate on a position of strength in Ukraine, because now that they're going to go towards military action, no one wants war, right? So Russians would try to strong arm the entire NATO alliance into making some kind of concession, because I mean, we all understand no one wants a war. Russia itself cannot handle a war against NATO, and Russia at the same time knows NATO will not want another war with Russia, because if there's now a direct war, we're talking about a complete nuclear warfare in that case, which is completely different altogether, and it would result in the destruction of the world. So you know, you look at it, you understand the Russian side, really the Kremlin understands it, that NATO will not want to have a direct confrontation, direct war in that way, and NATO itself also doesn't want to get into confrontation with Russia and the Donbas region, and Ukraine surely doesn't want to lose another part of its land. Now what is important obviously is for the Russians to be direct and to just say that the military confrontation is happening for a reason. Because look, these should not be simply military exercises. It's just saying that you can calm down, there's nothing to worry about. But again, in Crimea, when the world calmed down, the entire Russian government went to the next Crimean peninsula. So you can't tell them that you can calm down right now when you are already with so many troops in the region. Not to mention that you already have separatists fighting in the Donbas region. So if the US and Russia, if they really want to improve the relations, I'd say that work on Ukraine. Because Ukraine is a place where they can work together. Iran and others are different factors, they can wait. But now we're looking at a war-like situation in Ukraine, which is important to completely de-escalate at this particular point. But again, the Biden administration having imposed sanctions is slowly a way of again polarizing those very relations which need to be repaired between the US and the Russian government, so as to ensure that there is a de-escalation of tensions. Because right now the Biden administration is to understand Russia will not care about the economic measures the US government takes, so Russia will obviously find a loophole. As I said previously, country North Korea, Russia, they have found out loopholes in sanctions, be it US sanctions, UNSC sanctions. They have found out ways to find loopholes in them. So those economic measures are clearly not working as effectively as they should be. And it clearly shows the US needs to rethink the way it approaches Russia. And since Biden has called for a summit between the US and Russia, there needs to be a way in which both sides find a compromise. Because if the US can in fact work with the Russians, and if the Russians can say that if these tensions can be de-escalated by number of chances, it should be taken, for example. But the problem is, even if, because Biden actually called Putin to reduce tensions in the region and propose a summit of the leaders to tackle a number of disputes, and then the Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said that the Biden's offer of talks will be studied. The fact is that Kremlin clearly is not that interested in what the Americans have to say. What the Americans have to do first is they have to obviously begin certain compromise to Russia, or perhaps certain, because the President Biden has referred to President Putin as a killer, and there have been number one diplomatic statements made by the Americans against the Russians. And therefore the Russian government is now wanting, is perhaps even the Donbass region military confrontation could also be a way in which the Russians want the Americans to bow down before them and completely ask them to perhaps beg them for mercy, perhaps, because that's the only way I can see this thing going forward. And now the Americans have no other choice. Russia is now negotiating from a position of strength. They know that they have a military, they don't, that NATO doesn't want a military confrontation. Russia itself will not attack immediately, but they will ensure tensions keep rising in the region. And therefore, what NATO is trying to do is, number one, please, there cannot be an allowance of Ukraine to enter NATO, because if Ukraine enters NATO, Moscow says that's it, we are getting in. Because Moscow's clear view is this: if you NATO as an anti-Russia alliance, it was actually formed as an anti-Russia alliance back in the Cold War when the NATO was formed. It was an anti-Soviet alliance, now it's an anti-Russian alliance. And Russia does not want to be surrounded by countries which are NATO, they have NATO allies, because Russia knows any kind of argument, any kind of dispute comes in between them, or any kind of they might result in military confrontation. Russia is not really looking at fighting off against Ukraine or any other against Ukraine only. They're gonna be fighting with the US, the UK, the French, Germany, and other so many countries that are present in the NATO bloc as a whole. So if NATO actually wants to get down and speak to the Russians have to be direct about what is the reason behind a military confrontation, as to what is the reason behind these military tensions, and accordingly find out a good solution, a peaceful solution, to ensure that there is a comprehensive peaceful situation in the region. So guys, thanks so much for listening to the entire podcast. It's been pretty long, I understand, and it's just said we couldn't cover much in the past couple of months due to some technical issues, but right now we got the podcast back, and we've been and we'll try to work much more. We'll get all the content that you guys require, and I'm trying to analyze all the issues as they come in, and we'll be obviously like another new podcast that we do. In fact, we'll try to release another episode to cover the things happening in the Middle East so far. And I've also been writing a blog, so I'll provide a link in the description. Check it out, guys. There we actually break up some of the issues in much more explanatory terms. Like, for example, if we take one issue here which I explain in another short manner, you can check out the blog where I write it in great detail about every player and any, perhaps any conflict or any issue. We have just posted about 3 to 4 blog posts, so guys, just check it out and comment and like it out there. It's on WordPress, and I'll be giving the link in the description. Guys, thank you so much for listening to our podcast. Share it to family and friends, and give us your opinion on the issues that we covered. Tell us if you want us to cover any particular issue, and also continue to give us feedback. And thanks so much, guys.